We've all heard at least a little bit about how yoga is supposed to be beneficial to our overall well-being. But why? I'm Lindsay Moon, and today on Focus, we'll investigate. Neha Gothe joins me to talk about a study she recently completed comparing yoga's effects on memory to those of more traditional exercise. Her findings are fascinating and provide some scientific evidence for the argument that yoga is helpful. We'll also hear from Mayor Payne, one of the participants in Neha's study, about the changes she noticed in her own life after she started doing yoga. Then, in the second half of the hour, I'll talk with Jennifer Allen, a yoga instructor from Champaign, about the ways yoga has changed as it's been introduced to the West, and why some vehemently oppose the idea that yoga is exercise. That's all coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning, and welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon. Yoga has been around for thousands of years and is becoming more and more popular in the West as a form of exercise. Many people who are well practiced in the discipline, however, will say that yoga is much more than that. But what exactly that means isn't well researched. Later in the hour, we'll learn more about the traditional reasons people practiced yoga and about the different styles. But first, I want to welcome Neha Gothe and Mayor Payne to the program. Neha is an incoming professor of kinesiology at Wayne State University and recently finished her doctoral research at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign testing the effects of yoga on the brain. Mayor was a participant in her study. Neha, Mayor, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I do want to let our listeners know that we are not taking calls this hour, but we do still want to hear from you. Do you practice yoga? Why do you do it? And what do you like about it? Send us a tweet or find us on Facebook at Focus580. Neha, I want to start with you. In your study, you compared the effects of exercise, working with resistance bands and doing work with free weights versus yoga. What do we know about how exercise, like resistance bands, and what you compared yoga to affect the brain?
So the field of physical activity and cognition has been growing. There's been more and more interest since we know that there are some age-related declines as we age that happen, and there are some cognitive deficits that occur as we grow older. The oldest study that I know of and that is known in the literature was conducted in the 1970s. And since then, the field of physical activity, not only looking at exercising that involves aerobic activities like walking or jogging, but also looking at physical activity that is more of strength training and stretching has been looked at. And many of it, of course, the primary interest has been looking at more of the physical benefits that one gets out of exercise, but there are also these mental and cognitive benefits that take place simultaneously. There, again, isn't much that is known about yoga per se, because it's now kind of becoming popular, especially in the West. And so there is more and more interest in what these unique mind-body activities can do for your brain and how you can keep yourself sharper and more active physically as well as mentally by performing different forms of exercise and activities. So there are benefits in terms of improving your speed of processing, so being able to process information faster. There are studies that show that exercising helps you with your memory, so you're able to remember information better and process information better. There are some questionnaires which assess self-reported levels of memory and memory functioning, which show that participants report fewer moments of being forgetful and improved memory after engaging in regular exercise.
So when you set out to see what effects yoga could have on the brain, what exactly were you looking for?
We actually wanted to go ahead and compare yoga with what we know. So we decided to pick a group that would engage in stretching and strengthening exercises. So we wanted to compare yoga with a standard. When we started out and looking at some of the pilot data that was recently in the news, we found that a single session of yoga does improve your speed of processing. It improves your memory functioning, especially working memory.
And speed of processing, what do you mean by that exactly?
So speed of processing is essentially just a simple term of how quickly can you perceive some information, process it, and make a response that is appropriate.
And Mayor, I want to bring you into the conversation. You were a part of that study, and you were completely new to yoga when you first started as a participant. So tell me about that experience.
I was new to yoga. And initially, when I saw the call for participants, I thought this would be a good way to get to try yoga, to get into it. But I was secretly hoping I would be in the other group. And then by the time I got my assignment, I thought, okay, well, this will be a good thing for me to try under this class setting. And in fact, it was a great, great experience.
How was yoga different from other types of exercise you'd done before?
Dramatically different. It didn't feel like exercise. I've jogged. I've gone to the gym. I've played sports, volleyball and softball, and all of those things were way different than what happened in the yoga studio, which was very calming and very relaxing and very concentrating. And initially, I thought, I'm really terrible at this. But after just a few sessions, four or five sessions, I felt my confidence growing, and I started to get it. And I'm really kind of hooked.
So what she's describing and the fact that it was kind of hard to catch on to at first, but afterward, there was definitely a difference between other types of exercise. Did the other participants that were a part of the study have the same kind of feedback for you, Neha?
In fact, we designed the two groups such that they would do similar forms of exercise. So much as you do in stretching and strengthening exercises, you basically exercise all your major muscle groups, and you do certain exercises such as, say, arm curls or chair stands or something like that. So it's a simple exercise that you do repeatedly to improve your strength and muscle strength. In yoga, it is very similar, just that you do not use any equipment such as resistance bands or weights. It's more to do with your own body weight that works with and without gravity or with and against gravity, and that by itself works as some sort of a strengthening tool to improve. So the similarity between the two groups was the fact that they were physically very similar in terms of exercising your body. The difference between the two groups was that the yoga group did engage in some more of the breathing and meditative elements that are involved with yoga practice. And so the feedback that I got from both groups primarily differed on those two elements, that some participants really enjoyed the relaxation and the breathing and the meditation that was practiced during the yoga session.
And Mara, I talked with you a little bit about this, about the breathing and the meditation when you first started doing that. You and some of the people in the study, you said, kind of sat there thinking, well, what are we actually supposed to be doing right now?
That's right.
So tell me about how the meditation and the breathing part made yoga different from other exercise that you'd done before.
We had the benefit of a really good teacher who led us through that. And she recognized, because I think virtually, certainly the majority, if not, there were only a couple of people, I think, who had any experience with yoga before. So most of us were in the same boat of kind of looking around when she would start talking about the breathing and how you're supposed to be doing it. And it was important that she keep that sort of patter up and tell us how to sort of do this. And it took a while to sort of catch on to what we were supposed to be doing. But certainly, you know, within a few weeks, I think we all agreed that it was helpful and a big part of what this whole thing was supposed to be, that the breathing and the meditation, which we tried various things. That was really good too, that she tried different ways of doing the meditation. We walked around in a circle one time very, very slowly and with your eyes closed, which is kind of an interesting thing to try on your own. And some people I really like that. That seemed really to get me in a good zone. Other people didn't like that, but different ways that she approached that meditation part was worked for other people. So what you take away from that is you can practice this in many different ways and sort of find what works for you. And there's seemingly an endless variety of options.
And Neha, when you did this study, it was the breathing and the meditation part of yoga that you were interested in seeing how that affects the brain.
Yeah, so when we look at some of the previous studies that have been done looking at yoga and brain functioning, there are only a handful of them in the literature, and most of them tend to use a stronger combination of breathing primarily combined with some physical movements and some meditative elements. So it appears that at this point, of course, the results and the conclusion cannot be absolute, but it appears that the breathing and meditative elements are what improve your brain functioning. And that to some extent makes sense, because when you're doing yoga practice, it is so instructed, it is so guided, and it is also very in the moment. So when you're doing these breathing and meditative exercises, you are continuously guided by your practitioner or by the instructor to be in the moment, to keep your distracting thoughts away, to try and focus on your body, on your posture, on your breathing, on inhaling, on exhaling. So all these elements play a role in trying to keep your brain in the moment, practicing without getting distracted by anything around you. And I believe that is what is the mechanism that translates beyond yoga practice, beyond that room setting. When you go out and do your daily things, you're able to focus better, you're able to be calm and stay in the moment and get things done more efficiently. And that possibly could be a mechanism that yoga improves, or the way in which yoga improves cognitive functioning.
Are there any other forms of exercise that improve focus in that way?
There is certainly some evidence that a lot of the aerobic literature suggests that running or walking can be beneficial for older adults, and that they have seen certain similar trends that these individuals tend to improve with regular aerobic exercise or with regular exercise over longer periods of time. These studies are typically done for about 6 months to up to a year. And actually, most of this work has been pioneered on campus at UIUC by Dr. McCauley, who is at the Department of Kinesiology, who was my advisor, and his colleague, who is also the director of the Beckman Institute, Dr. Arthur Kramer, who is a neuroscientist. And they have seen that aerobic exercise seems to have similar benefits on the brain, but that takes up to 6 to 12 months to see those benefits. And here with the study that we conducted, we were able to see those kind of changes in a period of 8 weeks. So certainly exercise does have an influence on different variety of brain functioning and brain processes, mental processes. But again, depending on the type of exercise you do, these benefits may be more accelerated, or some things may take longer as compared to some others.
In this study, what you were testing out, specifically you were doing hatha yoga. Mir, what kind of poses did that incorporate, or what did you come to understand hatha yoga as?
Sun salutations and tree poses. We did, what was that, the happy baby? cobra. And then, of course, those all sort of flowed together thanks to our instructor leading us through them. That was hatha. And I know there are many kinds of different yoga, but that's the kind that I really liked.
And now that the study's over, are you continuing to do it?
Not in a class, although I did participate in the Saturday yoga at the park that the Urbana Park District is offering now. But I have done some on my own, and I've incorporated certainly some of the breathing exercises in times of stress. When my dog gets anxious over a storm and wakes me up in the middle of the night, I'm not anxious about the storm, but I'm awake, and so to get myself back to sleep, I've done some of the breathing exercises, and that really does help. When I'm talking to my mom on the phone sometimes, I think about that's a good way to sort of relax. But I have been doing some things that on my own at home.
So, Neha, a little bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about the different styles of yoga. You chose hatha for this study. Why, and what does that mean?
Hatha yoga is one of the, I would say, the more basic forms of the yoga system. It incorporates the physical movements or postures and also a combination of the breathing and meditative elements. There are different styles, certainly. I know some of them are more commercialized than some others. For instance, power yoga and Bikram yoga, I would be very honest, I don't think I buy into those at all. The whole practice of yoga is supposed to be more of ease, more of peace, just trying to calm you down. And so, of course, it has become a little more commercialized these days. But Hatha yoga remains to be the most popular form of exercise amongst middle-aged and older adults. Iyengar yoga is another style which includes a lot of props that are used. So they use a lot of bolsters and blocks and cushions. That is another style. But we chose Hatha yoga just because it is just challenging enough and it is also modifiable. So you can do the same posture. For instance, the downward dog, there might be participants who may not be able to put their two hands right in front of them on the ground. And so you can always prop them using some yoga blocks or just have them go as far as they can. So Hatha yoga allows you to do those modifications for all ages. We had these two instructors that I was very lucky to have in the program who had already some experience working with older adults and very easily could incorporate these postures and modifications during the classes. And primarily, again, I use this form of exercise because I wanted to have a good combination of breathing and meditative elements to it. Not many yoga postures, certainly not Iyengar yoga, include many of the meditative or breathing elements. So that was another reason that we went with Hatha yoga, because it's a good balance of postures, breathing, as well as meditation.
You did find that there were positive effects as far as focus and time of processing. Does that also have positive effects for memory?
Yes, we did use a variety of cognitive tests, tests to assess different cognitive functions. We assessed speed of processing, so how quickly are participants able to process a piece of information. We had some tasks which involved trying to remember pieces of information and then recalling them at a later time. So I'm sure Mayor would remember this particular one. We showed participants letters on the screen one at a time, and they were told to remember a string of five or a string of six and remember that at the end in the exact sequence that it was shown to them. And participants in the yoga group seemed to do this more effortlessly after the 8 weeks of practice as compared to our stretching controls. So certainly we looked at some of those memory pieces.
Mira, outside of the lab, did that translate for you while you were in the study?
Well, the fact that I couldn't remember that we did the downward-facing dog yoga pose. I sort of think it does.
Great. So, Neha, this study that we've been talking about was specifically for middle-aged and older adults. What do we know about the cognitive effects of yoga on people that are younger than 50 and 55?
So one of the studies that we conducted before conducting this 8-week program was the one which was recently in the news. We looked at college students, which were about, I think it was 30 college students, all females, and we looked at what happened to their cognition immediately following one bout of yoga exercise. So they participated in 20 minutes yoga, which was again a Hatha yoga program. So we had a sequence of physical postures, a little bit of breathing, and a little bit of relaxation and meditation. And we had them do some cognitive tests immediately after the 20 minutes of yoga practice. And we compared them, again, with aerobic exercise. So the same 30 participants came back to our lab, and we had them walk or jog on a treadmill for 20 minutes and assess some cognitive outcomes immediately after they were off the treadmill. And again, we saw that after yoga, their performance was better as compared to after aerobic exercise. So we know that there are some effects with younger groups, including college students. I think the mean age in that study was about 20 years. There have been some studies that have been done in different places, not as much in the United States, but there have been some studies done in India looking at 10 or 12-day yoga programs that are conducted for school children. It's kind of like a summer camp or a school camp. and they look at before and after effects after these camps are done and complete. And they have also noted some changes in attention and processing speed. There have been some studies that have looked at some behavioral outcomes as well. So individuals who may have attention deficit disorders or children who may have hyperactivity, and yoga seems to have an effect on those outcomes as well. So we see a broad spectrum across different age groups. Of course, the total number of studies is very, very low as you would compare with aerobic exercise, which is more widely studied, and there are so many different protocols and studies that we know of. However, yoga, I think, is still a very new topic that researchers are trying to explore, and I think it will continue to grow as it becomes more and more popular, especially in the West.
Neha, do you practice yoga?
I used to. I would say I'm not a regular practitioner as much as I used to. I did quite a bit when I was in India before coming here. But I do try to do a few things, not as much of the postures, but I certainly try to get some breathing and meditation done first thing in the mornings before I get out of bed and then start my day off with that.
Was it your own practice that sparked your interest in studying what the actual scientific, like, cognitive effects were of yoga?
To some extent, yes. When I did my schooling in India, yoga is actually a part of our PE time in schools and colleges. So I was introduced to it at a very young age. I was actually a lawn tennis athlete back in India, and I found that it would help me during my games and professional tournaments to just calm down and relax in between important points or big matches. And that kind of sparked my interest in trying to see how it would actually benefit and trying to objectively assess what would happen to the brain and your feeling and your body when you're practicing yoga regularly. To some extent, it was some of my personal experience at different points that led me to do this work. But certainly, just the fact that I have come across so many people who say that yoga practice makes them feel better, they feel more energized, they feel more calm. So all these subjective reports, to some extent, I felt like there was some need to do some scientific work and back it up and objectively study if those benefits actually take place with your regular yoga practice.
Neha Mehr, thanks very much for talking with me. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and this half hour on Focus, I've been talking with Neha Gothe, an incoming professor of kinesiology at Wayne State University, and Mehr Payne. Neha just recently finished her doctoral research at the University of Illinois about the effects of yoga on the brain. Mehr participated in her study. She conducted her research through the Exercise Psychology Lab at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and if you're interested in the lab or in participating in a study like Mehr, you can find a link to their website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about yoga. I'm Lindsay Moon, and you're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. Welcome back to Focus on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon. Today on the show, we're talking about yoga. During the first part of the program, we heard about yoga's effects on the brain, specifically on memory and how quickly we process thoughts. Now, I want to shift gears a bit and welcome Jennifer Allen to the program. She teaches yoga in Champaign and was one of the instructors for the study we talked about during the first part of today's program. Jennifer, welcome to Focus.
Hi, thanks.
Before we get started, I do want to remind our listeners that we are not taking calls this hour. This is a pre-recorded episode, but we would still love to hear from you. Do you have questions about yoga that we can answer in a future program, or do you practice yoga and have something that you want to add to our discussion? Send us a tweet at Focus580, find us on Facebook, or send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. So Jennifer, Neha Gothe, the researcher who is studying the effects of yoga on the brain, who we spoke with in the first part of the program, found that there were positive effects as far as speed of processing and memory goes when it comes to yoga. Were you surprised by those results?
Not at all.
Tell me about why you weren't.
Sure. And this goes into the progression of sort of why, what yoga was meant for, or why it goes into the history of where it came from. So the system of yoga is meant to start by strengthening the body so that then you can feel comfortable to sit and practice meditation. And the breathing practices, which are called pranayama, are also to help quiet the mind and sort of calm the nervous system so that then you're better able to focus, so that then you can build. Beginning meditation practices are all about building concentration and focus, and then move into more subtle states of experience. So meditation is absolutely an aspect, and yoga meditation is part of a yogic practice, is to build concentration and focus and will and all of those things. And that was absolutely my experience when I had been practicing the physical poses, which are asanas, for many, many years. But when I was introduced to pranayama, which I brought some dates with me so that I could remember, in 1997, I noticed a dramatic, I went to a workshop over a weekend, and literally over that weekend, I felt my thinking grow clearer, and I felt a lot of the just little things that, like, you don't want to do, like you don't want to do your dishes, and you sort of have a little fight with yourself of, oh, there's a sink full of dishes and I don't feel like getting to them. And I came home from the end of a full day workshop and was like, oh, there's a full sink of dishes. I should just go do them now. There was no, like, little internal battle or struggle about what I should do and what I should not. Everything felt very clear and easy to do. And that had been my experience ever since. Like, having that as a regular practice and including meditation in that is that it's just easier. All of the mechanisms, whether it's your physical body or thinking, thoughts, mind stuff, is just easier and smoother.
And so that was in 1996. When did you start just doing the yoga poses?
Well, my history, I am a dancer, and so I had started ballet in when I was 6 years old. So had been dancing for a long time, and then went to New York to NYU to be a dance major. And so while I was at New York, started taking yoga classes probably back in 1989, just as another physical practice. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Oregon, so I had known about yoga even from younger than that as something that was a good thing to do, that it was good for you. But I think I took my first yoga classes when I was in New York. And the studios that I studied at were all studios that integrated yogic philosophy with the practice, which I think in the early days, like in the 60s, 70s, was more the case. And now, as it's become, I would say contemporary yoga, because it's become so popular, it has become more westernized a lot. And a lot has been, some of that information has been watered down or lost a little bit as to the source of where it comes from. So those studios I was fortunate enough to be introduced to all had all of those aspects of what you really want to learn when you're studying yoga, which is more than just the physical poses.
Okay. I think that's interesting you bring that up, because as I was talking with Neha, our guest for the first part of the program, we were talking about yoga and framing it as exercise.
Right.
And I know there are a lot of people who are really strongly opposed to the idea of yoga being exercise.
Right.
Why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I saw that, I was laughing because I got my teacher training from an organization called the Integral Yoga Institute in New York, which also studies sort of, you learn to teach classical hatha yoga. And so on the exam for your graduation, or the final exam to complete the teacher training, that was one of the questions, was, is yoga a kind of aerobic exercise? And the correct answer was no. And I put quotes around correct. Like, that's what you were supposed to say, was that it is not. It kind of depends on how you think of the term exercise and what that means. Because when you're doing the asanas, you're absolutely exercising your physical body. Mm-hmm. You know, you're strengthening the muscles and the bones. You're creating more flexibility. So in that sense, you are exercising the body, but it is not necessarily a cardiovascular exercise. That's not what it was meant to be. It was definitely meant to be a sequence or a series of poses that you practice. You sit in the pose for a certain amount of time and have a few breaths, focus your mind and your concentration on something so that it's directing energy into different parts of the body. And then how those sequences of poses, like how they're ordered, how fast you do them, that's sort of what has become the more contemporary version of yoga that we know here in the West, is people taking that to an extreme of connecting the poses and having them do it very quickly. So when you hear styles like vinyasa or flow yoga, that's what they're doing. They're taking the poses, which just exist. There's, I don't remember how many there are, but there's hundreds of poses. And then you connect them in such a way so that it becomes more like a dance, and you're moving like you would more in an aerobics kind of class.
Okay.
Which there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but that's not really what it was meant to be in the beginning.
Okay. So yeah. Flow yoga, then you mentioned hatha yoga also. Mm-hmm. What are the defining characteristics of hatha yoga?
Right.
And what makes it different from all the rest of them?
Right. So do you mind if I give a little history of yoga?
Oh, no, please.
Because it's such a great question in terms of how sort of how that information has gotten confused with language in the States. So the idea of yoga is actually that yoga is a state that is achieved. And the definition of yoga means to yoke or to join together. And what you're joining is your mind and your body and your spirit. So it's all of those parts of you. You yoke together. And when you can do that, you achieve a state of yoga. So within wanting to achieve that state, and this is all in books that are very, very ancient. There's a book called the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali that sort of reads like a Bible of yoga. And it talks about, you know, this is the state that you want to achieve. Because when you achieve that state, you feel calm and relaxed and you are without suffering. And that's sort of the goal, is to be without suffering. Mm-hmm. So then there's all these different paths that you can take to achieve that state. And they all, and the paths sort of have to do with different temperaments for people. So people have different styles or really just temperaments of a human being. So some people are going to be more inclined to be more physically oriented. And so hatha yoga is the path of doing the physical poses, doing pranayama, the breath exercises, meditating, vegetarian diet. So it's focusing on sort of cleansing, purifying the body so that then you can be more more able to achieve that state of yoga. Then there's several other different paths. So karma yoga is the yoga of service. So you devote your life like if you were a monk or a nun, and all of your activities, all of your work is devoted to that idea of a divine something. And Raja yoga is a philosophical path, and Jnana yoga is also a philosophical path. So someone who just studies ancient texts and philosophy, they can achieve the state of yoga in that way. Bhakti yoga is more a practice of devotion and singing and prayer.
Okay, so when you're talking about yoga then, in some ways, it's not necessarily just stretches.
No.
It's so much more than that.
It's so much more. So what we think of as yoga in the West are all the different styles and interpretations of hatha yoga. So everybody is teaching hatha yoga in a way, because okay. Everyone is, all of those yoga classes are focusing on the body, on the physical practices and the breath practices in order to feel better. And those are all versions of hatha. So within that subset of hatha yoga, then you have all the like hundreds of styles. So you have Ashtanga and you have Vinyasa flow and you have Iyengar is just BKS Iyengar, his style of yoga, which is very classical hatha.
And he was a person. So that's his last name.
It's his last name. Yes. And his teacher, Krishnamacharya, was basically, he learned from his teacher and then he continued that system of very traditional sort of classic yoga, the way that it's practiced in India, which is definitely hatha yoga. But all the other styles are technically part of hatha yoga, but the way that they've become adapted is a lot less traditional, because normally hatha is meant to be that you're in a pose and you sit there and you breathe and then you shift into another pose. You're not necessarily connecting them into a moving flow, which is how so much has become interpreted now.
I do notice you are trained in the Alexander method.
Yes.
So what does that mean?
So the Alexander technique is a form of, I mean, it's incorrect to say a postural technique, but it is helping people figure out what they're doing in their daily activities. So most of us have daily habits, physical habits that we don't think about or we're not aware of anymore that cause us all kinds of pain or discomfort because it throws us out of alignment or out of the natural alignment of how we would move.
Can you give a few examples of what those might be?
Yeah, I mean, picking up the phone and balancing it on your shoulder and lifting your left shoulder so that you can, you know, cricking your neck so that you can hold the phone.
Okay.
And then if you are in, you know, an administrator and you do that all day long, odds are at some point you're going to start to have pain on the left side of your neck or your shoulder's going to start to bother you. But you have no, you don't necessarily make that connection that that physical thing that you're doing all day long is contributing to that. But it's really basic postural patterns, like how you sit, how you stand, how you walk. You know, when people stand, they usually rest on their right hip maybe, and so all of their weight is going onto the right side and they're kind of collapsing on the right side of their back. or when you walk, you thrust your hips forward, and maybe even when you stand, you thrust your hips forward, and so then you start developing pain in your lower back. And if you changed how you were standing or walking, that back pain would probably go away. But most people don't know that, so then they end up going to their doctor, and they get some kind of possible diagnosis that they have something wrong, and then they might go and get surgery or get physical therapy, and they may need those things, but they might not if they just changed how they were standing or walking.
Okay. So
it can have a dramatic effect. Yeah. Okay.
So then you go through with people who come take your classes and kind of talk about what those things could be.
Yeah. In the best setting, it's a one-on-one type of teaching environment. So I have people that come to me privately, and then I go through those basic postural motions that they would do in a day. Because I also teach yoga, a lot of my yoga students come to me for Alexander Technique lessons, and then that informs when they go back into a yoga class or when they're doing any kind of exercise, it's going to improve how they're doing those things.
You designed the yoga classes or the
The syllabus.
For the mm-hmm. study that we talked about during the first half of the mm-hmm. program. How do you go about creating a yoga sequence or a class mm-hmm. for a certain age group? I know that study specifically focused on older adults.
Right. This is kind of basic principles that are really should be present in any yoga class or any fitness class, and it often has to do with the spine and the movements of the spine. Mm-hmm. So in a yoga class, you want their spine to be moved in all of the basic directions that our spine can move. Our society is so sedentary now that we're sitting for long periods of time without moving, and it's not what we're meant to do. So making sure that you bring someone through a forward bend and a back bend and a side bend and a twist multiple times throughout a class helps to create that kind of stability and mobility and flexibility in their back. So any yoga class, and for this one, I was making sure that I was bringing people through those movements specifically, mm-hmm. Strengthening their legs, strengthening their hips so that it would be comfortable to sit. And then we always incorporated some balance poses because balance not only requires strength and stability, but it starts to have this aspect of concentration, of focus, and will, really. It takes a lot of willpower to try to balance on one leg.
Yeah.
A big component of doing any kind of balance is focusing your eyes on one spot and really gluing it to that to bring all of your focus to that one point. And that is the beginning practice of meditation, because meditation is referred to as one-pointed focus or one-pointed concentration. So all of those were components that were, you know, part of what I was considering and building. And then knowing that it would be an 8-week progressive class, so starting out simply with all of those sort of parameters and then starting to build a progression as they went along.
Okay. So I know that study was 8 weeks, and mm-hmm. we talked with her about, you know, we know that these are the effects that she found. If you were doing 2 or 3 classes a week for those 8 weeks, what mm-hmm. happens after that if you stop doing it? Mm. And so I have always really wondered. I have a lot of friends who will say, oh, I went to a yoga class, I didn't really like it, and they never went back.
Mm.
So mm-hmm. when someone is just starting to get acquainted with yoga,
yeah.
how many classes do you think, or how many times should you try it before you decide if it is or is not something that's for you? Because it's really intimidating at first a lot of times. Huh.
Do you know why? Did they ever explain to you more of why they weren't interested in going back?
I've heard people say, I just felt weird sitting on the floor not doing anything. Or And that's one of the comments that Mare made when we were talking about the study. She said, you know, we walked around at first and we just didn't know what we were supposed to be doing.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it was just disconcerting, because if you go to, you know, boot camp classes for fitness classes are really uh-huh. popular. And so you're kicking and you're up and down and off the ground. And uh-huh. no one really ever tells you at a fitness class, just sit and breathe. For uh-huh. a moment. So I think uh-huh. I'm curious as to if you have that experience as a teacher.
It's interesting. I mean, in your standard yoga class, particularly in the beginning, they're probably not going to focus on the breathing practices. This was an unusual focus of this study because of her interest in looking at the benefits specifically of doing the breath practices and meditation. Normally, a beginning yoga class would focus almost exclusively on the physical poses, the asanas, because it is considered a more advanced practice. Because for most people, it is boring and you don't understand why you're doing it because your mind is still flying around like a monkey. You know, it's literally called monkey mind in most meditative circles. So it is absolutely something that you would do later in a beginning class, it's sort of like how you treat kids. People's attention span is shorter. So you want to move them maybe a little bit quicker, teaching them these things so that they can feel their physical body strengthening. They can feel that changing. The pranayama and the meditation in the sort of system of yoga is considered the more advanced practice, and you wait until someone's ready for that. And that is very individual. Could be 10 years, could be 15, could be 1 year before they feel like they want to learn that. Mm-hmm. And then it should actually come from an internal desire, like, oh, I'm interested in that now. It should never be coming from someone telling you that it's good for you. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I have just always been interested by, it seems that there's a dichotomy between people who are really into yoga and they really enjoy it, mm-hmm. and the people who tried it and said, no, this is definitely not for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting why that split happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has a lot to do with Western culture in a way, and particularly as it's developed and everything becomes faster and our attention becomes shorter and shorter, our ability to focus on something for any length of time. And that's the way that yoga is really would help people, you know, when you talk about something like attention deficit disorder, mm-hmm. like learning how to build your concentration over time so that you can focus on something is obviously it would be a good thing. It would be beneficial to someone. Whether they're going to like doing that, that's another story.
Yeah.
But we can see that there are problems with having a short attention span, that we have higher anxiety rates, that people don't feel comfortable, that they're not happy. You know, there's a lot of suffering and things that go with that speed that we've inherited. So anything that can teach someone to slow down to a certain extent naturally without having to take a drug, in my mind, is a good thing. But it may not be comfortable for someone. And that would absolutely be why, you know, you have some people that would prefer, you know, to be jumping up and down, or there's music so that they can be sort of distracted by the music. You know, although lots of yoga classes, you know, have music in their classes at this point. But not all classes and not all styles are slower. And I think that's absolutely that's the answer to why so much of sort of more Western yoga has progressed to where it is, where it moves faster. There's music. There's things that feel more like an exercise fitness class. And then I think the idea is that if the system does what it's meant to do, then over time, if someone keeps practicing it, they might actually then start enjoying the meditation at the end a little longer, or the Shavasana at the end, and they might want to go to a class that has a little bit more of that silence or that space because they're starting to appreciate that more. But in the beginning, you know, they might not be interested in that at all.
You were talking earlier about going to a conference, I think you said, and coming home and doing your dishes and, you know, just saying, I absolutely have to do these. I can't let them sit here any longer. Mm-hmm. Was that the moment when you realized that doing yoga was having an effect on your life? Or when did you know that it was something that you were definitely going to keep doing because it was helping your focus?
I would say that absolutely that was the moment that I recognized the power of this other more subtle practice that we're talking about, which is pranayama, the breath practices, and then that leading into meditation and being more comfortable with sitting. I was not someone who could sit still and sit quietly at all when I was younger. I had been dancing since I was six. I was living in New York City. It's a very loud, you know, lots of overstimulation there. And, you know, I was working all day, working into the night. I would get home at 10 o'clock at night. I had a very active, busy lifestyle with a lot of input and a lot of information and was probably a pretty restless person. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, sitting still and quietly was not something that was comfortable for me necessarily. And I enjoyed yoga for its physical benefits for a long time. But when I took that workshop, I definitely noticed something very distinct about how I felt. I felt calm. I felt settled in myself. And like I said, I became aware of these things that I always had these internal battles with myself around putting off and not wanting to do. And it just wasn't there. It had disappeared. And it just felt very matter of fact and easy to do things that I hadn't wanted to do in the past. And that really made a big impression on me. So from that point on, for whatever reason, I realized, oh, pranayama is a really important thing for me. And I started doing it every day and it completely changed my life.
I want to switch gears for a minute and talk a little bit about age. So in the first half of today's program, we specifically discussed yoga's effects for older adults, ages 50 to 55. And I've seen conflicting information about whether it's healthy for young kids to do yoga. For example, the American Yoga Association does not recommend yoga for kids under the age of 16. Are there certain styles that are beneficial for certain age groups, or why would there be ages where yoga would not be recommended?
Right. I looked them up when you mentioned that because I wasn't familiar with that organization. And it's interesting. Their point for why they said it wasn't recommended for children under 16 was because of its effect on the endocrine system. And yoga, I mean, because of the way the asanas, the poses are, and spending time in them, it's strengthening the muscles and the bones, but it is also stimulating your glands, your endocrine system, which is one of the, I think, one of the mysterious aspects of the form that they've tried to do studies on to see, like, how is it affecting that system? Because it seems like that's one of the aspects of why it creates more vitality and health. So this organization's theory said that because the child's endocrine gland system is something that's still developing up until that age, that you don't want to be significantly changing it in some way. That's one organization's opinion. I've never heard that before, so that's why I was interested to go and look and see. I think that's on the more conservative end approach of how you could think of that. There's a lot of kids yoga classes out there from all different organizations. The Iyengar method is one of the more rigorous methods of training for yoga, and they do research in India, and they've been around for a really long time, and they teach classes for kids. It's just modified. So you're not going to be doing the same kind of class that an adult would be doing. First of all, their attention is shorter. So right. You don't hold poses for as long. But it's absolutely giving them a relationship to their body of strength and building coordination. The classic sequence that's done in most yoga classes of the sun salutation was, from my understanding, was basically created for PE in India to give. It's like the equivalent of doing burpees here in the States, which I didn't know what that was, but my husband told me about burpees. Do you know what burpees are?
So you jump up,
jump down, do a push-up, jump back up.
Yeah.
Right. So it's exactly right. So it's a physical strengthening, gets your energy going, and then they make them do it 30 times or something. So the sun salutation was the equivalent of that teaching for, I think, adolescents, kids in school, you know, in their PE. Like, this was another kind of version of that. And now that's been incorporated into yoga as a system to wake the body up, get it going. So there's nothing I would say that would be inhibiting a child learning yoga, as long as they were in a class that was, you know, that was really geared for children. So the poses and the structure had been modified for their attention and for their bodies.
Okay.
And I would say in general, for most age groups, it's a similar question because age is such an interesting, you know, someone who's been practicing yoga for a long time and they get older, they're going to be in a level and in a class the same as anyone else. That it really comes down to whether you're a beginner learning yoga, I think, is more the issue. And for anyone who's starting, if you've never taken a yoga class, you should go to an introduction to yoga type of class. Because then you're really learning the names of the kinds of poses that are done most often. And there'll be a progression where you'll learn something that starts and progresses over a certain period or length of time. So that then if you were to walk into another yoga class at a studio, you would have a familiarity with what they're doing and you could follow it. And that would be my main recommendation, is that if someone's interested in starting to learn yoga, that they really go take an introduction to yoga class, which the Iyengar studio here has and the Living Yoga Center has. They have like a progressive intro class that lasts 8 weeks or something. And that's kind of, I would say that would be my strong answer, particularly if someone's older, they would want to start from the beginning so mm-hmm. that they're really able to learn what they need to modify. Also, if there are some things that are harder for them to do at that time of life.
This might be a more basic question, but what does namaste actually mean?
So the literal translation, which is quite lovely, means I bow to you. So it's my greetings, my salutations, but I bow to you and I bow to my divine being bows to your divine being. So that's in its broadest, its literal translation. And then how that gets used in regular society, it can also be transferred as greetings or good day or be well. So in India, they'll often place their hands together in front of their heart and they'll just do a little bow and say namaste. And it's just saying greetings, you know, or hello or goodbye. But in its, in its definition, it's bowing to the divine person, the divine being in that person. So it's an acknowledgement of that divinity, which is quite lovely, you know. And it's coming from a culture that where divine spirit wasn't separated from anything else, so that you there's more of an integration of that idea of a spirit and a person and a mind and a body being all in one package.
Okay, so yeah. Then at the I think at the end of a yoga class, the uh-huh. instructor will say namaste, and then yes. everyone will bow. So yes. it's not just like at the end of a jazzercise class where they would, you know, thanks everyone for coming. So it's much deeper than that. Then.
It has a deeper meaning, but it can. I mean, it exists on multiple levels. So in a way, it's the same. You know, you're thanking at the end of a jazzercise class. Someone's, you know, I'm thanking you for all being there. The class wouldn't have happened mm-hmm. without the participants. So. It is the same in a way. It's just that in our culture, we've separated, you know, church and state for, I think, good reasons. But then there's a little bit of something that gets lost because then we become afraid to acknowledge the fact that there is this other thing happening, you know, whatever you want to call it, whether it's soul, spirit, you know, you don't have to get into an argument about religion, but just clearly there's something there. And this phrase is just acknowledging that, you know, while at the same time thanking people for participating in the class. So... Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jennifer, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and this half hour on Focus, I've been talking with Jennifer Allen. She's a yoga instructor from Champaign and was involved with the study we heard about during the first half of today's show about yoga's effects on the brain. You can find out more about the study we learned about in the first half of today's show and about Jennifer and her practice by visiting our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Jason Croft is our technical director, and I suppose it's only appropriate today. Namaste. You've been listening to Focus on WILL AM 580.